My name is Larry Gottlieb, and let me give you a little sense of who I am. I was born in Los Angeles, and I've been in the Valley, in or around the Valley, since my mother, who was a concert violinist, was hired to perform at the Aspen Music Festival in the summer of 1957. So I had my 12th birthday that summer, and I came with her for 12 summers after that. And so I feel like I kind of grew up in the Valley, even though I went elsewhere for school. And I went to high school in LA, and I discovered I had a passion for trying to understand how the world works. I had a great physics teacher, Mr. Corbin, and he really ignited that passion in me. The lab equipment was completely rudimentary and hard to use and didn't really help much, but somehow the way he expressed some of the ideas in physics really turned me on. And I thought, I want to do this. I want to know how the world works. I had no idea what I would do with that or what a career would look like. But after high school, I went off to MIT. I went off to Boston got a bachelor's degree in physics. And along the way, I joined a rock and roll band. And the guys that I was playing with were also in Aspen during the summer. And our first gig was in the summer of 1965, playing for Don here, who owned a little club called Galena Street East. And I remember that real clearly. It's, 60 years ago or something like that, almost. So we go back a ways. So after my bachelor's degree, I'd had enough of living in a place where the snow turns black the next day. So I left Boston and went back to San Diego, where I had been recommended to a program by my advisor at MIT. I went to the University of California, San Diego in La Jolla, and I enrolled in a PhD program, and I didn't really know what I was going to do with that either, but maybe a professor or something like that. I didn't really like playing in a lab, and I wasn't really up to all a blackboard full of squiggles. But I liked to think about physics. I liked to see if I could grasp concepts, and I thought I might be able to teach them. So that was in the fall of 67. In 1969, I got distracted, or actually diverted, redirected by opposition to the war in Vietnam. What was going on in the quad was much more interesting than what was going on in the classroom, and I sort of tilted from mostly in the classroom to mostly in the quad. And after an event called People's Park, which took place in Berkeley in 1969, I left school entirely. And I became involved with others who were trying to end the war. And the way we were trying to do that, we figured that we started an underground newspaper called the San Diego Street Journal. And we figured that if we could just inform people about what the powers that be were doing in their name, they would rise up and call a halt to it. That's not what happened, but that's what we were trying to do. And what I found was that the more we pushed against the establishment, the powers that be, the more they pushed back. And things got a little weird, from firebombs in the backseat of my car to bullet holes in the front door of our office downtown, and we moved the whole thing into a couple of big houses in very posh residential area around downtown San Diego. I'm sure the neighbors were just thrilled by that. But and actually, that's where the firebombing took place, was outside that house. And so we mounted an armed guard on the place for about 7.5 months. And after that time, it was like, okay, this is silly. This is not doing what I wanted it to do. And those guys that I had played music with in Don's club in Aspen said, why don't you come back to Aspen? We're here. We got acoustic guitars and a gig that pays $5 a month. And I said, sold. So I came back to Aspen in the winter of 69, 70. And I've kind of been, for the most part, here ever since. I had a music career that started in earnest in about 1970, and I got to tour nationally with John Denver. I got to open for Steve Martin and share the bill with Kenny Rogers one week, and I got to do some fun things, got to do some national television, and that was great fun. It was, and I was treated very well, especially by John, and I will always treasure those experiences. Along the way, I had an experience in the space of about a half an hour, completely changed the way I look at the world, completely changed the way I look at being in the world. I'm not going to try to give you that experience, that experience here. It's chapter 7 in this book. So those of you who go home with one or have one can read chapter 7. It was a profound transformative experience, and I've spent much of the last 50 years learning how to articulate what I saw that day in those 30 minutes and sharing it with others, and that's what this book is about. So to start us off, I'd like to do a short reading, a parable to start us off. Imagine, if you will, that each of us is a newborn fish. In the few days since we were born, we've cautiously swum about some, but now Mom has gathered us together to teach us about the world. She points out rocks, and that some good things to eat might be found around them or under them. She tells us about the sand, and that there are some creatures that look like sand but might want to sting us. She lets us know about what's good to eat and what might want to eat us. And eventually, we come to feel as if we have this fish thing wired. What she doesn't tell us about, of course, is water, because she doesn't know about water. She doesn't know about water because water is all she's ever known. But imagine that one day something happens to you that takes you out of your well-understood reality. In this case, it comes in the form of feeling something sharp and foreign in your mouth. You're jerked around and pulled upwards, and suddenly you cross some kind of boundary and you can't breathe. You've been caught. Fortunately for you, you're in a catch and release area and you're gently put back where you belong. And now you know about the existence of water. You know about water by experiencing what we might call not water. You're able to make a distinction, in other words, between water and everything else. One day, many years ago, I found out about the water I'd been swimming in, and that changed everything. And it gave rise to this inquiry, which forms the subject of this book. So my education in physics got put on the shelf when I started my music career, and then I did IT work in the Valley, and I was for 4 years Mayor Basalt, and I did a lot of things around here, and the physics was always on the shelf. When I had that experience I just referred to, and as I tried to understand what had happened to me, there were several concepts that I remembered from my education that said, well, that's interesting. That seems like that applies to what I just experienced. I wonder what the relationship is between physics and spirituality, which was a word that I started to use in those days. So let me tell you that physics can be very useful, not only in pointing the way to new technology, from transistors to cell phones and all the rest, but also in demonstrating the value of taking a step back from any confusing or frustrating situation and viewing it from a broader perspective. And I'll try to give you an idea of what I mean by that. So I need to explain just a few terms from physics and concepts to make my book's message a little easier to understand. There's a lot more physics in Hoodwinked, but there's no math. So it's okay. You can read about the physics. It's conceptual, but I've worked real hard to make it understandable, and there's no quiz afterwards. If any of this confuses you, don't worry. We won't dwell on it. And it's just to get us all on the same page regarding the use of certain terms. As I said, there are many ideas from physics that can be brought to bear on the human condition. And the one I would like to emphasize tonight is the pointed to by the word field. Now, this is not the sort of field where you grow stuff. This is the kind of field that people, physicists, have invented in order to make thinking about things easier. And I'll give you an example of that. Fields are intangible. You can't touch a field like you can touch a table or a music stand or a book. They're conceptual. They're inventions in the mind of human beings. And hopefully, they're ideas that humans use to make sense of what we observe. Because some of what we observe in physics doesn't make sense. We could have a talk in another talk about quantum physics where very little of it makes sense, but we're not going there tonight. So let's talk about fields in the context of physics. Basically, fields permeate all of space, and they have the capacity to exert influence on everything embedded in them. And we'll use as an example the gravitational field. We're all familiar with the gravitational field. We all know that if I let go of this, it will fall. We don't question that. So its effects are easily observable. And gravity dominates our earthly experience. Without gravity, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have the elements that are necessary to make one of these, because those were born in stars, and stars were formed by gravity pulling matter together into a very dense, hot soup. The pressure of all that mass created lots of heat, and that heat served to alchemize and synthesize heavier elements. Without that, we wouldn't be here. Not only that, but without there, we couldn't walk. We'd go floating off into space. We couldn't dance. We couldn't do any of the things we take for granted as human beings. And again, gravity permeates all of space. So if you look out at the night sky whenever the clouds go away, you can see a long ways, which means you can see light coming from objects that are very far away and from which light left long time ago. And gravity's all out there. All of those things were formed and are held in whatever place they are by gravity. So gravity is everywhere. And it's invisible. The gravitational field is invisible and it's intangible. It's an idea. It's transparent. In other words, there's gravity all the way from here to the next star, but you can see the next star. So obviously that gravitational field is transparent. What we've found is that all fields sustain vibration. Another field that we're all familiar with, even if we don't know the name of it, is the electromagnetic field. And the vibrations of that field are what we call light. Obviously, the electromagnetic field sustains vibrations, or there would be no light in the physical world. And gravity, Einstein said, well, gravity, he sort of invented the idea of the gravitational field. He said, well, if it's a field, it should sustain vibration. It took 100 years for other physicists to develop instruments sensitive enough to detect those gravitational waves. And within the last decade, we've done that. We, as the scientific community, have found gravitational waves. We've found ways to measure them, and they're now giving us another way of looking at the physical universe and looking for data or information as to how to understand it. We think of this stuff as continuous. We think, for example, of, I don't know what this table's made of. Is it wood or metal or what? It's metal. Okay, so we think of that metal as being continuous. It looks continuous. There, we don't see any gaps, right? But it's made of atoms. And as you may know, atoms are mostly empty space. From the perspective of the particle view of the world, of the universe, atoms are mostly empty space. In fact, scientists figured out ways of firing charged particles at atoms, and mostly they went right through. Once in a while, they would bounce back because there's a nucleus in the center. Takes up a very small portion of the atom, but that nucleus causes this charged particle to bounce back, and that's how we know they're mostly empty space from a particle point of view. So the idea that matter, that this stuff is continuous, is an illusion. It's essentially an optical illusion. And we're taught that matter is made of fundamental particles, and we think of those fundamental particles the way we think of everything else, which is tiny objects. But it turns out that the object view of the constituents of matter doesn't work very well. And so early in the last century, when people were working out this thing called quantum physics, they discovered that matter is actually a wave phenomenon. It's actually a field phenomenon. When we evolved from thinking of the world as made of particles to made of fields, we got much better predictions. We got much clearer understanding, and we got much better technologies. Transistors, cell phones, and GPS would be impossible without the field understanding of the world. So I've talked about a couple different fields. Let's generalize the characteristics of fields. Now, first we said they permeate all of space. They're intangible and they can't be seen or touched, etc. And they're entirely conceptual. Their sole purpose is to simplify understanding. So when we say the world is made of fields, what we really mean is that when we think from a field perspective or in a field paradigm, as opposed to a particle paradigm, we get better answers. We get better understanding. We're able to develop better technology. How do fields simplify understanding, you may ask? Okay, let's go back to gravity. So initial attempts to understand gravity, which took place in the 1600s, led by a fellow named Isaac Newton, were conducted within what I call a force paradigm. Newton talked about the force with which the sun holds the earth in its orbit. He talked about gravitational force, and he developed mathematics that pretty well explained where the earth would be in 6 months or where the moon would be in 6 days. He could pretty much explain that with the math that he developed. But he was looking at it from a force perspective, gravitational force. You can feel that gravitational force. You can feel gravity. You can feel it in your butt right now against the chair. You can feel it in your feet on the floor. Hard to explain, however, what that force is made of or what the source of that force is. Yes, there's a massive body under my feet called Earth, but how does it pull me? Better yet, how does the sun reach over 93 million miles and hold the Earth in its orbit? That's called action. Einstein called that action at a distance. Or how does the Earth hold the moon in its orbit over 250,000 miles or something like that? There's no ready explanation for that. And in fact, Newton in 1700 or whenever he was writing, threw up his hands. He said, I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you where the Earth's going to be, but I don't know how it works. It took over 200 years for a fellow named Einstein to come along and give us a different explanation, a field-based explanation for how it works. Before I get to Einstein, there are problems with the force paradigm of gravity. The first one is how can the sun reach out over 93 million miles? But there are other problems. If you take, let's say, the sun and the Earth, and you use Newton's math, you can pretty much figure out how that's going to affect the orbit of the Earth. When you add in the moon, of course, since the moon is going around the Earth, which is going around the sun, it kind of wobbles because when the moon is over here, it kind of pulls on the Earth that way. And then when the moon is over here, it kind of pulls on the Earth that way. And so there's wobbling going on. And when you add in all the other planets, all the asteroids, and all the other stuff out there, it gets really complicated. If you go to Google and you say, and you type in something like gravitational force or sun and gravity, sun and moon, you'll get a fairly simple equation. It's Newton's equation. If you type in three body problem, which involves three separate masses, each exerting an influence on one another, the math fills up the whole page. And in fact, three body problem has become a way of referring to a problem that's too hard to solve. As soon as you add that third body, let alone the fourth or fifth, things get really complicated. And Jupiter, by the way, has 95 moons at the latest count. So things get really complicated over there. So let me read you something. This is the way I wrote it back in 2021. The idea that forces act across distance with no visible means of connection gave way to a new conception, that of the field. A field in physics permeates all of space and in so doing connects objects at a distance. An example would be the gravitational field, which connects massive objects and carries their mutual attraction. Because of his work, physicists now think of matter as telling space-time how to warp, and space-time telling matter how to move. Let me give you a visualization of that sentence. Picture a trampoline out in your backyard. It's a really stiff trampoline. It's absolutely flat. It's smooth. There are no glitches in it. And you take a billiard ball and you roll it across the trampoline. And in the absence of, I don't know, wind or imperfections in the material, it'll roll in a straight line. Now you take a bowling ball and you put it in the center of the trampoline. So the bowling ball is heavy enough to really make a divot in the trampoline. So here's the bowling ball. Roll the trampoline over here. It'll curve. Why? Because there's a force between the bowling ball and the billiard ball? No, because the bowling ball has warped the surface of the trampoline, and that warp causes the billiard ball to curve. In fact, if you roll the billiard ball at just the right direction, at just the right speed, it'll orbit the bowling ball. Well, that's a way to visualize how gravity works. The sun warps space-time, and the objects around it move as they would if space-time is curved. So there's no the problem of force, the problem of action at a distance goes away. The whole force paradigm goes away because gravitational, we're now conceiving of gravity as a field, and the field connects these objects and forms the context in which they have their in which they move. And the three-body problem goes away too. So you're no longer considering, well, how does the sun affect the earth? You're only considering, how does the sun affect the field? The field affects the earth. And when you add in the moon's just adding its contribution to the field. The earth will move in accordance with the field. So the whole three-body problem, that whole complexity of how do all these different things interact goes away. Let me remind you of the one idea I want you to take with you into the next section, which is that fields are not tangible. They're invented to explain and visualize what we observe. So I told you that physics is useful in looking at the human condition, so I better deliver on that promise. So I want to start with a term that is used in a number of different contexts in which I create a slightly different meaning for, and that word is ego. Ego, E-G-O. The simplest definition I saw of ego is the part of human responsible for arrogance, boastfulness, or belligerence. So that's kind of simplistic in addition to being simple. Freud's definition of the ego, of course, is much more complex. I read this morning that the ego moderates the self-interested id in order to get along with others, and the superego internalizes the parent's worldview with its rules. In any case, the ego is something you have. So we speak about my ego. Mostly we speak about their ego when we observe how other people behave. So it's something you have and probably wish you didn't. Now, egos interact. They trigger one another. So I had an experience last week when a family member said something to me, and the words this person used made pretty perfect sense, but the tone in which they were delivered triggered me. That trigger was a strong trigger. I felt belittled and I felt dissed and quite upset. And so my ego was operating as a controller, and it got me up off my chair and made me go inside and wash the dishes, which is an interesting result. But in any case, so egos interact with one another. It's kind of like the two-body problem when you have two people. And then you get to the three-body problem. And in the three-body problem, which again is a reference to systems that are too complex to consider just one interaction between two entities, you have to try to, people are trying from that perspective to understand wars and inequality and general bad large-scale behavior, which our world is rife with. Right now you have Putin's ego and you have Biden's ego and you have Netanyahu's and you have Trump's and you have those of their parents, which are still active within them too. You have all their followers and critics and all their egos and the media's egos and our egos. That's really the three-body problem in human affairs. And it's not comprehensible. I'd say it's not comprehensible. And our efforts to resolve those problems from that three-body problem, that particle context, that particle paradigm, isn't working. So we live inside a force paradigm of human relations. And I can, I'll tell you a little bit about how mine got started. But we try to force other people to behave the way we want them to behave. And in fact, we also try to force ourselves to behave the way we think we should behave or the way we've been told we behave. And mostly that doesn't work either. But that's what we try. We live inside that paradigm. We live in a force paradigm. And nothing really changes. So I'm going to propose to you a new paradigm in which to consider human relations. And I'm going to use the idea of the field. And I'm going to call that field the egoic field. So we're going to move away from my ego and your ego and his ego. And we're going to talk about the field, the egoic field that we're all immersed in, just like all those planets and stars are immersed in the gravitational field. Along the lines of the parable that I read you, where the fish are in the ocean and they don't know they're in the ocean. They don't even know there is an ocean. They're just there because they don't know any better. They don't know any different. We're immersed in an ocean of ego. That ocean, that field is conceptual. It's not tangible. You can't see it. It's invisible. Actually, it's transparent. We look through that ocean of ego, through that egoic field at everything we look at. And that field distorts everything we look at. And you know how I know that it distorts everything we look at? Because I believe in my heart that if we saw the way things really are, we could stop doing what we're doing to make things worse. But we don't see the way things really are because we're looking through this field. We're looking through this. Well, it's not entirely transparent. Maybe it's translucent. Maybe we see something through the field, but not accurately whatever it is that we're looking at. Well, how do we wind up in this field? Are we just born into this field? And I would say, no, the field is recreated by each human being. And how does that happen? Well, we embed ourselves in this field as a worldview. As beginning humans, as we learn language. So when language is taught to us, it's taught to us from a perspective. It's never, just like the news, it's never delivered exactly as it is. It's delivered from a particular perspective, whether it's left, right, or center, or woke, whatever word you want to apply to it, it's still delivered from a perspective. Language is taught to us from a perspective. It's taught to us from a worldview. How else could our parents do it? They understand how the world works, and their words that they teach us reflect that worldview. So as we learn language, we embed ourselves in this worldview, and I'm going to change the word worldview to the egoic field. We immerse ourselves in the egoic field by learning language and by interacting with other people. In terms of that worldview, we are those egos. We become those egos. And that ego, it becomes an invented self or constitutes an invented self. So we adapt ourselves to who we think we need to be in order to please people, not upset people, be taken care of, get along with others, be highly regarded and ultimately to be loved, we think we have to be a certain way. We think we have to be certain people. And so, and that constitutes an ego self within the egoic field. The egoic field, which is the water we swim in terms of that parable, has the force paradigm built into it. So when I was young, my parents tried to force me to be who they thought I should be. They did that with sticks and carrots, with punishments and rewards, sometimes bribes. Those of us who are in this room who are parents have either tried to emulate that because we feel like it worked pretty well, or because we feel like that's the only way of doing it, or we reject it entirely and try to do something different. The ego self operates in a field that has the force paradigm built into it. A slight detour. Are you anybody familiar with the word taxonomy? Taxonomy is the classification scheme by which you figure out where an animal belongs in the tree of life, or a plant belongs in the tree of life. So taxonomy terms talks about domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. It's a very complex classification scheme that's been developed in order to say, well, this species is related to that one. They're both part of the same genus, or they're both part of the same phylum. So for a human being, the kingdom is animal, the class is primate, and the genus is homo. So I left a few out. Now, our species is Homo sapiens, technically speaking. Interestingly enough, our genus, the genus Homo, has only one species, ours. There were other Homo species, but we dominated them and wiped them out. And somebody told me yesterday or last weekend that of all the genuses on the planet, ours, Homo, is the only one with only one species. So in terms of that classification scheme, we don't have any competition. But the force paradigm is built into the way we look at the world. It's built into worldview. So competition has to arise somewhere so we can beat with each other. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a natural thing when you stand back and you look at that, because it's built into the worldview. So if we have no competition in our genus, we have to compete with each other. It will show up. The egoic field blinds us to our true nature as one. We're one species. And hoodwinks us into thinking and believing in the illusion that we are separate. If you go over McClure Pass and you look to your left and you see that aspen grove, it's one organism. But it doesn't look that way. They're part of one thing and they don't compete with each other. So the competition apparently arises as a function of forgetting that we're one. We believe we're separate because early on in our adoption of our worldview, we're taught to identify with these, and these are separate. And when you identify with this, it's natural to assume that we're separate. And the ego as something you have, the egoic self, is based on this idea of separation. The egoic self can't survive in a paradigm in which all is seen to be one. It requires separation in order to be. Now, we humans behave as if we are this ego, and the complexity of the three-body problem arises as we try to understand human interactions. If you have two people, individual psychology works with self-aware people or a good shrink. And if you add a third person, like if you and she have a child, you and he have a child, now you have a third person, well, now you're in the family domain, and that can work with three individuals if you have a good family therapist, or you're really focused and you're really present to your interaction with your spouse and with this new child. But you add more people and it gets just as complicated as it does with all those celestial bodies up there in the 95 moons of Jupiter. And that's just the way it is. It's complicated, and that's why most things of the order of more than two bodies don't get resolved, or many things don't get resolved, because we're still dealing with individual entities, individual ego selves. So this new paradigm I'm suggesting, the ego as a field, that field is foreign to us. It's not part of who we are. It's something that we learn. It's something that's transmitted from generation to generation. And it has its own agenda. This is the tricky part. The egoic field that we're embedded in has its own agenda. What do you suppose that agenda is?
Being right.
Being right, but as a means to what?
Survival.
Survival. That's the egoic field's intent, or that's what it's up to, is surviving. And guess what? It uses us to do that. And the way it survives is by evading our notice. How does it do that? By pitting us against one another, by presenting us with problems that are too difficult to solve with the way we've been given to think about them. It survives because we don't notice it. We don't notice the water we swim in any more than the fish does. It doesn't have our best interests in mind, and its agenda is to survive no matter what. It doesn't care whether we survive. It only cares that it survives. The first time I heard that was in a workshop in Aspen, and my mind said, "This is evil. You need to get out of here." And I went, "Who said that? That wasn't me." It was clearly a foreign voice in my sphere, in my psyche, that said that. And from that moment, I've always known that I could separate myself from that voice wasn't mine. Now, I still listen to it a lot, and sometimes it gets me in trouble. But I know that it's not who I am. I know it's a foreign installation that I adopted voluntarily. Why did I do that? I was trying to get along. I was trying to please my parents, trying to be liked, trying to be respected. So in order to survive, the ego has to pit us against one another. And it will do whatever it has to do to avoid oneness, because it thrives on separation. In fact, it can't exist without separation. So it promotes adversary, competition, mutual blame, and it promotes those struggles through anger, shame, resentment, and all other negative emotions, and none of it solves anything. It just makes you feel better temporarily. And being angry at somebody feels better than being totally despondent for a while, but it doesn't really solve anything. So here's another parable for you, and I want you to see if you can imagine this for yourself. Imagine yourself as one of the biggest, baddest dinosaurs about 66 million years ago. There you are, king of the world, having perfected dominant and predator without any meaningful challengers. And then one day, here comes this giant asteroid, and the next day, its impact with the Earth has made your life ultimately impossible. You have no way of evolving, and so you perish. And in so doing, you make room for the rise of mammals and eventually us. It's kind of sobering. In the current version of the story about that asteroid, its effect upon the Earth was planet-wide. You can think of the results of that impact as being present everywhere in the biosphere and having the capability of affecting every object within its scope, just like those fields I was talking about earlier. I'm proposing that we think of the ego as just such a field. It's the water we swim in, and everybody is looking at life through it. It's planet-wide, because each and every human culture has a few fundamental invisible beliefs at its core. One such universally held belief is that we are separate beings, separate from one another and from the universe, from all that is. And the belief that we're all on our own, together with the belief in the scarcity of resources, dooms us to conflict and competition. If you read or watch the news, you'll see the effect of that egoic field upon us humans and our institutions, and you will see it everywhere. So what's the answer? What's the answer to the egoic field? What's the answer to realizing that looking at ourselves as independent, free-thinking, what's the phrase in economics? It's like enlightened self-interest, that we're all acting from enlightened self-interest, is an illusion. It's a myth. We're doing the bidding of the egoic field, and it doesn't have our best interests in mind, only its. So what's the solution? See, the egoic field, which distorts everything we look at, makes true progress, true healing, impossible. As long as we think the way things look through the ego is the way things they actually are, there is no solution to our problems. If we wish to experience the freedom that is our birthright, what is demanded of us is to break free of the ego, to recognize it as an invention, whose power is a superstition. What we have to do is drive a wedge between the ego, the invented self, and who we really are. How do you do that? Well, what I've discovered is the ego is loud, and it's self-righteous, and it knows that it knows best, and it talks to me in that tone of voice. To the degree to which I identify with the ego, I talk in that self-righteous voice. Well, the ego is very loud, and it clamors at us 24/7, but there is another voice. There is another voice, but it speaks to us, for the most part, very softly. So how do you hear that voice? Well, you have to turn down the volume of the other one. You have to turn down the volume of the egoic field as it speaks to you, and mindfulness, meditation, a walk in the woods, anything that you use to quiet your mind will turn down the volume of the egoic field speaking to you and allow you to hear that much quieter voice. In fact, that voice whispers to us. And the dedication of Hoodwinked is to all those who hear the whispering. And I say that because you're in this room and we're having this conversation, although it's a one-sided conversation so far, the fact that you're here tells me that you hear the whispering. You've heard that whispering. Whether you're facile at quieting all that other stuff and really intently following, or you're just beginning and you get little glimpses, little intuitive glimpses, doesn't matter. If you hear that whispering, if you've ever heard that whispering, you know there's another voice. When I do that, when I quiet that voice in my head, that voice that said, this is evil, you need to get out of here. When I quiet that voice, I can hear that gentler, quieter whispering. And when I do that, I realize that it's calm and serene and unhurried. It doesn't need me to wake up right now. It doesn't need me to change who I am being in the world right now. It's patient with me. And we can learn to tune in through it through any of those mindfulness practices I mentioned before. And when I do that, I feel my connection to the whole. I don't know that I can say I feel oneness, but I feel my connection to the whole. I feel my connection to everybody else. Now, that has a greatly calming and inspiring effect on me. It can also make me heartbroken. And as a Jew, looking at what's going on in the Middle East right now, I'm heartbroken. But I also know that it's always possible to step further back and take a broader view. Wherever I'm looking at the world from, I know I can always step back a little further. This book will take you back further to a place where if you absorb what's in here, you will feel better and you will have the tools to feel better no matter what's going on out there. And when you feel better, you'll feel the love that's there, that's always there when it's not being obscured by all this other stuff. And as the Beatles said, all you need is love. And it's really true. All you need is love. Love will carry the day no matter what's going on. So I invite you, each of you, to take this book and read it once, twice, three times, and make a commitment to listening to that whisper within yourself that never leads you astray. That voice is within each one of us, and all we have to do is quiet down everything else, and we can hear it, and it will tell us what the way forward is for the greatest good of all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So if there are any questions, I'll do my best. You know, it's no surprise that it takes practice. I mean, I've been practicing listening to the egoic field for 78 years. And all of you have practiced listening to that same field speak to you in your voice. How insidious is that? For as long as you've been alive. So of course it takes practice. You know, creating a new habit to replace an old one always takes practice. But it's worth it. You could even say it's why we're here. I would say that there are three domains that human beings operate in. The first two we're very good at. It's having and doing. And mostly when there's a problem that we identify and we feel like we have to solve, we use having and doing. We have good ideas. We have the right resources. We have the right people in our lives. And what we do is important. We've been trying to solve problems for many thousands of years with doing. And when it doesn't work, we do it more. And when that doesn't work, we do it better. And when that doesn't work, we do it differently. The problem is in the domain of doing. The domain of doing doesn't fix anything. The domain that has power in our lives is the third domain, and that's the domain of being. You be who you are, who you really are, not who you thought you had to be, and not who you were told you had to be. You be who you are, and that peace and serenity and love that you feel within you will come to the fore, and it radiates out through the field. The quantum field, the field of possibility, sustains vibrations just like all other fields. You'll vibrate out through that field when you're present to who you really are. That's all we need. There's a critical mass there somewhere. I don't know how many it is. I don't know how close we are from it. But when we get to that critical mass, it will turn things around. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that will happen while I'm still on the planet, but it doesn't matter because we're all in the service of, all of us who hear the whispering are in the service of that. Mm-hmm. We can now trade our allegiance from the egoic field to the oneness that we all are. And just like the egoic field infects everything around the person who's focused on that, focusing on the essence of who we are, the oneness that we are, also will radiate out and affect everything out there. Mm-hmm. So just be who you are. Just be at peace. Just be in love. That's all you have to do. That's all you have to do is be. Now I'm really confusing things. Anyone else? It has been an enormous privilege to sit on this stool and address you all and see your smiling faces. And I so appreciate you being here. It's kind of meaningless to think about doing this without you. So I appreciate your participation and your presence here.